Hello, and welcome to episode 15, the Pink Moon edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. At a time when three of the world's major religions are celebrating their rituals of freedom, rebirth, and resurrection, it seems appropriate to bring all these spiritual rituals under the umbrella of the moon that Native American tribes in eastern North America call the Pink Moon. The name comes from the pink phlox wildflowers that bloom at this time of year. As I look outside my window, I can see the pink buds of the dogwood blooms getting ready to blossom. While we can always use a little more sun and warmth in western New York, we at least can rest assured that the worst of winter is behind us. Whenever I run, it's always on empty, but I do like to walk, and that's what I'll be doing on the morning of April 24th when the 1891 Run for the Opera House takes place. I had a chat with the executive director of the Opera House, Mr. Rick Davis, about this year's upcoming run. Rick Davis, welcome to the program. You know, it's been a long time. You haven't been here since your very first appearance on the very first podcast. I don't know what took me so long to get you back.
Well, you've been so busy interviewing all these other celebrities and more interesting people.
Well, I don't know. You're a pretty interesting guy, Rick. I mean, you know, and you're pretty busy lately, too. I know. Yeah. I mean, you got a lot on your plate. So thanks for dropping by.
Sure.
Of course, I'm having you here because the Opera House has a really big fundraising event coming up, and that's the 1891 run. For the Opera House. That's hard to say. It's a major event. And, for the last 2 years, it didn't have it 1 year. It's been virtual, stuff like that. And I know we're trying to get more people to come and more people to do it in person. So why don't you give us a rundown on the event?
Sure. And as you say, this is our major fundraiser for the year. You know, we used to do gala dinners and auctions, and those seemed to kind of run their course. And this was something that we thought back in 2018, we thought, it would be kind of fun and maybe easier to put on a run and reach out to a bit of a different audience for us, a different group of supporters, people who go from run to run throughout the summer and well, throughout the year, actually. There are even some in winter. So back 2018, we did the first 1891 run. It's a 5K run walk, and it went well. Were we wrong that it was easy to do? It was not. It's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun work, and it's a kind of a different work for us. It's not the same as presenting performance events, and we kind of actually enjoy it. So it's this year. It's held. This will be the fifth year. We actually haven't missed a year, even during COVID. Although in 2020, the run became virtual. And then last year, in 2021, we did a hybrid run. So you could run it virtually or you could come in person. And we had a smaller in-person crowd do the run, but there was a crowd for it. So this year, it's Sunday, April 24th at 9 in the morning. It's a 5K certified route, which means that the USA Track and Field Association has come in and has measured the route and certified that it's actually 5K to the inch, and it will qualify runners to use their time, their results in other competitions and tournaments that average multiple result times from multiple runs and determine other prizes and such. So you can use our run to qualify for other type tournaments. And it's starts on Day Street right next to our parking lot. And it runs around the Opera House building down Temple Street to the Central Avenue intersection, goes up Central Ave to the college entrance, goes onto the campus, a little bit around Ring Road to by the stadium, and then goes out onto Brigham, down to Temple Street, and then back Temple Street all the way to the Opera House, and ends right in front of the Opera House. And we typically have had, so last year we had about 60 runners, was a small number for us. The first 2 years, 2018, 2019, we were about 145 runners and growing, and we're hoping for that many again this year. And we see runners of all ages, from under 15 to I think we have an 83-year-old running the race so far this year. I think that's the top age. But everybody is eligible for a medal. We have we award medals to the top three male and female overall finishers, as well as to the top three finishers in six or seven different age brackets. So you have a chance to medal, and there's door prizes, and there's raffles going on, and every runner is eligible or is given raffle tickets, complimentary, and their swag bag. So you're, if you don't earn a medal, you might win a door prize or a raffle prize. But it's a lot of fun. It's a quick event. The gun goes off at 9 o'clock, and the first runner is crossing the finish line usually 18 minutes later. Wow. Or thereabouts. Yeah. And even the walkers usually come in under an hour, and then we're doing our medal ceremony and drawing for door prizes, and everybody's pretty much done and gone and on their way by noon. And some of our dedicated diehard runners, they're off to run another race in the afternoon somewhere, which is, I'll tell you, that's not me.
are you running, Rick?
I am not running. I would be walking. I'm so impressed. The first year we ran this, there was a lady from Buffalo, and she came down, she ran, and she medaled for her age bracket. She was 73 years old, I think, at the time. Mm-hmm. And she said, when she finished, she said, "Now, listen, if I know you won't mail medals to the winners who aren't sticking around, but I've got to go. I've got another race this afternoon in Buffalo." And I thought to myself, you know, that is so impressive. I'm actually going to mail your medal to you. I did. I admired her, and I'm sure she probably medaled there too, because she was really committed.
Oh, geez. Yeah. There's some of them are very, very, very much, very, very much in shape. Have you got, it's a great event, actually. And I think you're absolutely right. The thing that you said about the fact that it draws a completely different crowd from, the typical gala dinners or public performances or anything like that. You're going to be able to cast a wider net to get some people, running at the Opera House who are there for the run, but we get their contribution. So what an amazing event. I know that probably the woman, the 73-year-old woman who medaled for the run is a good story, but I was wondering if you had any more, or how people react to the event in general.
We've had people be really excited about it. We've had parents and children run and walk together. We had one member of the Opera House who's actually been a longtime supporter. The first year he walked, and the second year he walked, and last year he participated in the hybrid run in person, and he ran because he had but he was going through some life changes, lost a good bit of weight, was working on his health and overcoming some medical challenges. And it was absolutely wonderful to see him running that race last year and come in you know, less than half the time that he had, that his results were for the first year.
Wow.
So there's wonderful stories about that. And you hear, and he was proud of it, and you hear from him. They tell you that story. We have seen new people. Part of the objective, you know, just when we first decided to do this, yes, it was to appeal to a whole different audience from a financial donation perspective, but also it was to increase the exposure of the Opera House.
Right.
And so we have heard from people who here in the area, never been in the theater. Some people didn't even know there was a theater inside the Village Hall. Mm. They've told us that. So the first few years we actually had some entertainment inside happening inside the theater for all those runners. You know, what do you do when you come in after 15 minutes or 18 minutes or 25 minutes and your medal ceremony isn't going to start until the last walker, you know, is over the finish line. So we had some entertainment inside. So it brought people into the theater, and some of them would say, you know, I never have been in here before. That's really a beautiful space. And I'm really glad that I got to see it, and I'll be back. So it's accomplished that objective as well, adding some exposure for the theater.
This
year in our, we have a little brochure that we, that we put together that we send out to people on our mailing list to encourage, folks to register for the run. And, this year we included little quotes that we had, that we pulled from all the runs over the past 4 years. We always send out not an evaluation form, but we send an email out to all the red participants afterwards to say, okay, what worked for you this year? How can we improve the run for next year? And, you know, give us some feedback. And there's one that one lady wrote in, this was more fun than I should be allowed to have on a Sunday morning. and I that resonates with me.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, that's great. So there were other people, you know, saying how much fun they had. And so that also has been really nice to know that people have been enjoying it maybe as much as they enjoy coming for events.
Well, you know, I did the virtual run both times, and when I started in 2020, I think, and I'm definitely going to do the walk this year. I think 5K is about my limit in terms of walking, so you know, but I'll get there. And I really, you know, encourage people to go because, you know, for me it's a pleasant walk. I mean, it's really a nice route. There's some nice scenery. You chit chat with people as you go along. So, you know, I can think of way worse ways to spend an hour than just, you know, walking with a bunch of people for a good cause.
And it's a fast course. So for people who are, it's a very pleasant walk. All the walkers, we have the walkers do the entire route on the sidewalk. But for the runners, they're running in the road, and there's a lead and follow car from the Fredonia Police Department. So we've got some security there for the runners. But it's a fast course, except for when you turn from Temple Street onto Central, where there's a very small incline. Mm-hmm. It's a relatively flat course. So runners find that their times are tend to be on the fast side. And I should mention that our run this year is, this run is the second qualifying run for the Chautauqua Striders Runner of the Year series. One of those kind of tournaments that I mentioned where you can, your time qualifies you to be in the running for this Runner of the Year status. And we're excited about that. So we hope that will bring some additional runners as well. People that we don't normally see or haven't seen in the past.
Have you given any thought to expanding to a bike course at some point in time?
Yeah, that was actually one of the comments that came in. I think the second year, what before it was virtual and before it was hybrid, was the fact that maybe we should expand it to also either include a 10K or to have bikers as well. We don't feel that we really have the process down fully yet for the 5K. So we kind of want to get a little bit more experience under our belt doing that. I will
Okay.
say one of the challenges is covering the entire route from a traffic perspective. The runners all take off all at once and there's the lead car, but then they tend to space out a little bit and you've got your follow car in the road behind the slowest runner. But you need people along the route to kind of stop cars from entering into in the middle of runners, for
Right,
example.
right.
So this takes a lot of volunteers. I will say that's one aspect that we're still kind of struggling with, is getting the right type of volunteers and the right number of them out there to stop that traffic. We can't close the roads off entirely for the run because we don't have enough runners yet, and because they're major thoroughfares. That's one of the benefits of doing it on a at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning in April. There's not really a lot of traffic to begin with, but we do want the runners to be safe, and so we are continuing to work on that traffic control aspect of it. And I will say that we do have need for this year for more volunteers, especially to help out with that aspect. So if any of the podcast listeners are not runners, not walkers, but would like to be involved, we can surely use you as a volunteer.
All right. Well, I certainly will see you there, Rick. I know on Sunday
Yeah.
morning it's going to be great, and I'm sure I'll enjoy the experience. I got to make sure I've got my water bottle and my running shoes all set to
Yeah.
go.
Yeah.
Any last words for encouraging people to come out? Is
Well,
this is a rain
go
or
ahead.
shine event, by the way, right?
Yeah, it's a rain or shine or snow event. So, and if you, two things, I guess I would add. If you live along the course, along Central or Temple, come on out at some point after 9 o'clock and cheer on the runners and show your support for them. Just wave and cheer and applaud. I'm sure they'll appreciate that. And also, maybe you're out of town, or you're going to be out of town that day, and you can't participate, or this just isn't your thing. We have armchair runners this year, so that we can. We were accepting people who just want to make a donation and support the Opera House, and we're calling them armchair runners. So
Great.
there's that opportunity as well. And I probably should say how you can register and get more information, and that's. The best way is on our website at fredopera.org. Right on our homepage, at the top of the page in the menu bar, there's a link for 1891 Run. Or you can scroll down that homepage a little bit and there's an event blurb about it. And that you can link to that from that to more information. And that'll give you links to register online as well. So.
Yeah, and I'll probably put the links on the show notes for the podcast too. So we'll be covered.
Oh, perfect.
We'll be covered
Perfect.
always, always.
Great.
All right,
Great.
Rick. Listen, thanks for your time as always. Always great to talk to you. And if you ever have any events you want to publicize on
On
your
our
podcast,
podcast.
you just let me know.
I'll be happy to do that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rick. See you later.
Thanks, Tom. Bye.
If you're interested in participating in the 1891 run for the Opera House, please visit the Fredonia Opera House website at www.fredopera.org or check out the show notes for this podcast for more information.
Thank you.
During a trip to England, I managed to take a 7-hour day trip via the Channel to Paris, where my first stop was the Cathedral of Notre Dame. It's an impressive structure, one which inspired the 19th century French novelist Victor Hugo to write a sprawling novel about a disfigured child raised in the bell towers of Notre Dame who falls in love with a young Roma gypsy. Made famous by the Charles Laughton movie and the Disney animated musical, the theater artists at the Main Street Studios in Fredonia will be bringing this story to life in late April. I spoke with a few of the artists involved in the production. Well, I'm back in the studios of Main Street Studios in downtown Fredonia. We're here to preview The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which will be coming up soon. And with me is Ben Sheedy. He's playing the part of Dom Claude Furlow. And I also have with me Ashley Giacho. She is the associate director of the production. Welcome both.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Yeah. You bet. And thanks, of course, as always, for letting me use your studio. It always just feels so much more real for some reason. I don't know why that is, but it's really cool.
Absolutely, our pleasure.
Now, Ashley, tell me a little bit about what the production is going to be about, what it's going to feature. If you'd like to give a synopsis of the story, that'd be fine. But you know, just give us a broad overview, broad context.
Yeah, of course. So we're doing Hunchback of Notre Dame. It is the stage version of the movie from Disney. And it's casted with all Fredonia students and alumni, so we're using the space here.
To clarify, this isn't a Disney production. The stage play or the stage musical was written by Alan Menken. So the music is not the same that you see in the film version, the animated Disney version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Tell us, just remind us about the story, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Just what is it about?
I was kind of surprised to find that it's a great deal about the story of Frollo. Dom Claude Frollo, my character, is tasked with caring for this illegitimate child he names Quasimodo. It's his brother's child who he had with a gypsy girl. The gypsy girl has the child, dies of pox, and he is also ailing, and in his last few moments he appeals to his brother Frollo to take care of the child. And then it's the story of on the day of the Feast of Fools, Quasimodo sneaks out of his refuge in the bell tower of Notre Dame and goes out and really makes a mess of things. But that's where he runs into the character Esmeralda, who kind of bewitches everyone in the cast of characters, and hilarity ensues.
So Ben, what have you discovered about the character that doing the role that you maybe hadn't thought of when you first entered the production, first rehearsals?
The story starts and ends with his character, and he is the driving force behind the plot moving forward. Quasimodo does break from the routine that Frollo has established for the two of them, and that's the inciting incident that sets everything else into action. But the thing that carries the show forward is Frollo's drive to try to control everything. And that wasn't much of a surprise to me. I mean, everyone knows that even if you only have a passing familiarity with the Disney version of this story, you know that Frollo is the one trying to, at the risk of sounding, of minimizing it, he's the villain. He's the one who's trying to get control over everyone, and he uses the church to do so because the church was such a figure of authority. But I was surprised to discover how layered the character is, how complex the character is.
Hello, I'm Gavin Card. I am covering for Frollo, who is a crazy, power-obsessed archdeacon of Notre Dame in charge of Quasimodo, which he has taken very seriously in hiding him away. I'm actually from Jamestown, New York, just about 40 minutes down the road. And the building that we are putting this on in used to be my ancestors' seed factory. So there's a really strange connection there. And to be working in the building is nostalgic, especially since I live right next door to the theater. So it's great to just be able to walk out the door and jump into the rehearsal space and work on the set, building the bell tower and decorating it. I am extremely excited about Hunchback. One of my favorite character types is the villain with a backstory that has a reason for what he's doing. Frollo's reason is Quasimodo and his brother, who is Quasimodo's father. So I'm excited to jump into this role.
So the music in this particular production, I'm very curious about it. So many people who go to these epic things, as you say, like Les Mis, and they're familiar with the Andrew Lloyd Webber style of creating music. Does this have that same style? Are there any echoes, tones about the quality of the music that makes it feel like that? Or has a completely different direction been taken?
In terms of the scale, because Les Mis has such a big sound, the sound itself is part of the spectacle in many productions of Les Mis, I would say that that is present in the music of The Hunchback of Notre Dame as well. We're happy to welcome one of the players who will be playing Quasimodo to the studio and to the podcast right now, Jong Sang-ru. Jong, would you care to weigh in on the music as it pertains or as it compares to other large musicals? Like, we were talking about Les Mis because it is another musical derived from a Victor Hugo novel.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, the song was composed by Alan Menken. He has done many similar things to Les Miserables in terms of style, of it kind of being Golden Age, but more contemporary-like. It does a wonderful job of storytelling rather than it just being an entertainment show song. It tells a story. It does a wonderful job of being able to bring out the best in each part of the harmonies as it sings. It's really interesting how it does that too, even though it's, some songs are very whispered, some songs not. It's just very nice.
And so now that I have one of the actors playing Quasimodo, tell me something about the character then. I've been asking about the other characters. I've asked Ben about Frollo. Let me ask you about the challenges in playing such a character whose name just automatically conjures so many different images for people.
Yeah, so the role of Quasimodo, it's been interesting to decipher how to go about portraying this character, this fictional character, but rather challenging not to offend anyone or any part of the community. He is essentially deaf. And in the novel, I believe he mentions that he has broken words just simply because he doesn't know what words exactly are, what certain words go together to make a full sentence. So trying to do that respectfully while being able to communicate the fact that he is hearing impaired is kind of difficult so far with the vocal. So how I've at least interpreted it is the character doesn't know how to vocalize rather than not knowing the words. So to respectfully portray that role, that is the way that I have personally decided to go about speaking the lines of his. And another interesting part is I am a person of color, and being able to tell this story as a person of color kind of changes the narrative completely almost. So going about it in that way, you know, it the script and the writing and the characters' relationships do help a lot to kind of get that across to the audience members. It's kind of obvious if you put it that way. But yeah, it's definitely been a role I have been very much dreaming of portraying since I found that it was a show, and I'm very glad to have the opportunity to do so in such a respected group of people and a company to be able to do that.
Is there, are there parts in the show where you sing?
Yes, many times.
Yes? Okay, so my question is, because I'm trying to piece it together now. So you are doing a very studious job of making sure that when the character speaks, we understand that, you know, he doesn't have the words and so on. But what about when the character sings? Is there a difference?
Very much so. For me personally, at least, I think when he sings, it's more so in his head, not really out loud. So he's almost singing to himself, but drawing pictures while doing that, because as we mentioned, the lyrics are very colorful. It tells a story. So when he does sing, it's like he's in a whole different world, almost. Yeah, so, and on top of that, it's challenging to sing the parts that he sings, because it's very difficult part as a normal human being, not as like a counter tenor, being able to hit those notes. So as a creative decision and as a health reason, I've decided to personally not do a voice per se when singing. Mm-hmm. And interpreting in a sense of being in his head and sounding like how everyone would sound in the
production. Hi, I'm Alice Keft, and I'm playing the role of Esmeralda. Esmeralda is a big role about a young woman who grew up with the gypsies. She was kidnapped when she was a child and only knows this life. My background is, I am half Armenian and half Jewish. I'm first generation. I come from a family of immigrants, and they are from many places. I am so excited about being in Hunchback because this gives me an opportunity to grow. I have never played a lead before, and especially this character, I feel as though I can resonate so much with her and really see her for who she is. And being able to analyze this character has made me see how much I am very similar to her. And I can't wait to show other people who she is.
Ashley, let me go back to you. Can you describe some of the, I'm interested in some of the spectacle, what you're going to have for sets, what we're going to see as we come on the stage, the different locales. How are you going about creating those, moving those around, and preparing them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been finding all sorts of ways to include this sort of magical quality that this version of Paris has. So for Quasimodo's bell tower, we've been including scaffolding. We have ladders and all of this sort of really, like, grassroots sort of ways to show this space and all of its sort of rundown nature as opposed to the rest of Paris. And a lot of that comes through just the actors themselves being so magnetic and alive. We've thought about different ways to include fabrics to show the festivals and fire. So yeah, it should be very, very beautiful.
And what about costuming?
We have a lot of colorful costumes, and there will be an awful lot. There's a whole group, a whole section of the cast of characters described as gypsies. So the nature of those characters are that they've come from all over. So there will be some costumes that look uniform. There will be some costumes like mine as a member of the clergy, mm-hmm. all look like that. And then there will be other entire groups. And there are soldiers. So there will be members of the cast who look like soldiers. And then there will be whole groups could be sort of a hodgepodge in terms of the costuming.
It sounds like you've got the elements that you need. And again, you know, for me, it's always, wow, you know, the show is so epic, so large, and the space is small, relatively speaking. So, you know, trying to balance those two aspects of it is I imagine, got to be the greatest challenge in the world.
Ashley touched on this earlier when she was talking about the staging of it with regard to where the audience observes. A lot of this, we tried to do this with A Christmas Carol, too. I think we're trying to do it a little bit more with this production. a lot of the action is immersive for the audience, and I think that that helps to create the size. Because on a Broadway stage, there is that divide. It's a proscenium arch. You're looking through the fourth wall. You're sitting in the audience. They're playing on stage. Not so much in this case. Some of the action will take place in and around the audience seating. I think that will help bridge the gap between a smaller space and a larger show.
Let's get some summations about the experience for you.
The overall experience so far, which hasn't even been a week, has been incredible to be able to see what's already going to be. That is the final piece, essentially. You see the puzzle pieces right now, and it's exciting to see where it's going to go.
Ashley?
It has been just a crazy, like, week of, like, everyone being in the space, and I think we are making a really beautiful version of a beautiful novel. The music is stunning, and I think, going back to the question of space, I think you might even lose something in a bigger space, at least how we're doing it. The just feeling so close to the actors in a setting like this has been a great experience.
Ben.
This has been a process that hasn't been without its hiccups. Always there are scheduling conflicts. Always there are obstacles we have to get around. And so there are times where it feels like you're limping through the process. And every once in a while, even as early on as we are, every once in a while, something will sort of snap together and pop. And you do get to glimpse the final product. And I'm always kind of floored and humbled every time that happens.
All right. Listen, thank you all three of you for coming into the studio. Ben, thank you for letting me use Main Street Studios' recording studio. It really is kind of nice in here. And, you know, maybe someday I'll be able to graduate from my office in my home to having a nice setup like this.
Absolutely our pleasure. Come back anytime and every time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Special previews of The Hunchback of Notre Dame will be on April 27th and 28th at 7 p.m. The show dates and times are April 29th at 7 p.m., April 30th at 1 p.m., and again at 7 p.m., May 1st at 1 p.m., May 5th and 6th at 7 p.m., and May 7th at 1 p.m. Tickets are cash only at the door the night of the performance, and are $25 for general admission and $20 for students. More information is available on their website at mainstreetstudios.org. Here's what else is going on in the region for the next 2 weeks. The Marion Art Gallery will be presenting the Senior Showcase, a collection of artwork from the graduating seniors of the Department of Visual Arts and New Media, opening on Tuesday, April 19th, and running until Sunday, May 8th. The opening reception will be Friday, April 22nd, beginning at 6 p.m. Admission is free. Check the Art Gallery website for open times. Fredonia Chambermaid Guitar will perform on Tuesday, April 19th at 8 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall. The Fredonia Concert Band will perform on Wednesday, April 20th at 8 p.m. in the King Concert Hall of the Rockefeller Arts Center. The Fredonia Guitar Ensemble and Quartets will perform a concert on April 21st in the Rausch Recital Hall beginning at 8 p.m. The concert will feature original compositions by Cornell University composer Miles Jefferson and composer Azaria Felton. Envisions BA Capstones will present the capstone work of the BA cohort of the students of the Department of Theater and Dance. Their work will be presented on April 22nd at 7:30 p.m. and on April 23rd at 2 p.m. in the Bartlett Theater. In conjunction with Envisions, the BA Symposium will present their projects on April 27th in the Costello Community Room at the Rockefeller Arts Center. The annual Masterworks Concert featuring the Western New York Chamber Orchestra and the Fredonia Select Choir will take place on Sunday, April 24th at 4 p.m. in King Concert Hall. Admission for this event is $20. And finally, the Fredonia Wind Ensemble, conducted by Donna Dolson, will perform in the King Concert Hall on April 26th. The Flute Ensemble, directed by Barry Crawford, will perform on April 27th in the Rausch Recital Hall. And the Fredonia Jazz Orchestra will perform on April 28th, also in Rausch Recital Hall. All these concerts from the School of Music, with the exception of the Masterworks Concert, are free and begin at 8 p.m. Tickets for events at the Opera House can be purchased online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891. Tickets for all campus events can also be purchased online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets or by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501. If you'd like your arts event mentioned on the podcast, just send us an email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Please allow 4 weeks advance notice for a timely mention.
I'll be the grandest lady in the East.
West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River.
As a singer-songwriter, John Denver was relentlessly optimistic. His music was influenced by many different genres, but not truly connected to any particular one, seemingly rising above them all, like his high tenor voice. When people began to tell Ted Vigil that he bore a striking resemblance to John Denver, Ted decided to learn to play the guitar and hit the road, performing John Denver's music. I caught up with him, literally, by phone, as he was preparing to do a show in Grants Pass, Oregon. I'm joined now by Mr. Ted Vigil. Ted is going to be coming to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Friday, 4/29, April 29th, and he's going to be bringing his show, Remembering John Denver. Ted, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's great to be with you this morning, or wonderful, this afternoon, or whatever time it is there.
Well, just so the audience knows, you're out on the West Coast. I think you're out in Oregon getting set for a show tonight.
Right.
And you've been traveling so long that the first thing I want to do is thank you for your time, because I know that the travel has been you know, really pretty intense for you. So I'm really appreciative of the little time that you can give us.
All right. No problem.
All right. Before we talk about your show, before we talk about John Denver and all of that, I'm very interested in your own background first. I know you grew up in the Puget Sound area of the Pacific Northwest, and you're a singer-songwriter yourself, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. I've always loved music, been a singer since I was a little boy, and involved in drama and musicals, and then in the band, stage band, marching band, you name it.
Did you have a particular instrument that you liked to play?
Well, I started off with the drums, drums and percussion, and I played all through high school. And then I was in rock bands, and I was the lead singer and the drummer in some rock bands that I played. Did some top 40, and then we did some original material as well. And so my main instrument was the drums until I started doing the tribute show.
Right, and how did you manage to pick up the guitar?
Well, I guess it was a situation where people said, "Man, you should think about doing a John Denver tribute show. The way you look and your voice is similar." And so I did. I opened for Elvis, obviously not the real Elvis, but I did just a few songs, and I sang the track, and the people loved the show. They loved the music. They missed John. So my wife said, "Gosh, you know, if you're going to keep doing this, you're going to have to learn how to play the guitar." I said, "I think you're right." So that's kind of how it started.
Oh, okay. That's interesting, because one of my questions was going to be, how did you actually get started doing this? But you sort of already answered that question. So let me just follow up a little bit like that, because I mean, everybody on every place that I've done my research about your show and John Denver says you look uncannily like him. And I had a picture of John Denver up and a picture of you up, and I swear, if I put them side by side and didn't know which was which, I'm not sure that I could tell the difference.
That happens to me sometimes.
Is that something that you've been doing this tribute show now for, I think, over a decade, I believe? Does that get to you every once in a while, or do you just enjoy it so much it never bothers you?
I have to tell you, I enjoy every minute of this. I have some of my old musician buddies, you know, from the rock band days. Man, aren't you getting tired of this? You know, doing the John Denver thing, I'm like, oh my gosh, every year it gets better.
Wow.
I enjoy it so much. And I'll tell you, the main thing that happens to me at every show is I get people to tell me stories about their excellent experience with John and how his music helped them through something, or it was a big part of their life, whether it was at their wedding or whatever it was. John just touched so many people's lives, and to get to bring that to people and let them relive those awesome memories and good times, it never gets old, I'll tell you that.
Wow. Well, that's great, because anybody that can keep something going for, you know, 10 years like that, where it's the same, pretty much the same thing every night, and they still love it, that says a lot about the quality of what it is that they're doing, I think.
Yeah, it's and I mix it up, you know. I mean, I do different songs in John's catalog, and I'll do during my show, if I'm playing with a band, I'll do a few solo songs, you know, just me and the guitar. And John did a lot of shows like that, you know, and there's just something really special about just the voice and one instrument. It's really something very intimate.
Yeah, it is. You say that it's not, you know, you're not an impersonator, but it's it's sort of a tribute to his. And one of the things I noticed in listening to your versions of John's music versus, you know, his own recorded albums, you do introduce some different stylizations, some different phrasing. You know, there's subtle differences in the way you perform John's music. It's not an exact copy.
Yeah, I worked with John's lead guitar player, Steve Weisberg, for about 4.5 years. And he noticed that I was just trying really hard to do exactly all the phrasing and the way he would sing. And he said, you know, Ted, I'll tell you this. He said, I've worked with a lot of different tribute guys. He said, you got a great singing voice, but you're trying too hard, and it sounds funny when you try to impersonate. He said, this was such a freedom for me. He said, just sing the songs. You are a tribute artist. Just sing them well, sing them with your whole heart, and it'll be better. And oh my gosh, it really was. It really helped me out. So I try to sing the songs with the heart and feeling that John sang them, because man, what an incredible vocalist and writer and poet. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. He was kind of an interesting character. You know, I'll be honest with you and tell you, I'm one of those people who's old enough to have remembered John Denver's music live. You know, he was I was in college when he was popular, and it's interesting too, because one of the things that always plagued John Denver, I think, during the time that he was active and doing his best work, was the fact that he was so hard to categorize. And at the time, during the time period, nobody really knew whether he was a country artist, a folk artist, a pop artist, or where he fit. I mean, when you play his music, how does that observation strike you?
Boy, I'll tell you, but you just said it right there in a nutshell. You can't categorize it. you look at songs like Calypso, and then you look at a song like Back Home Again, which has a real country folk feel, totally different in style and the way he would sing. I think that he really covered several genres of music and even kind of made his own.
Yeah, in some sense, I have to agree with you because, I listen to his music, and every time I turn around, I don't know what to do with it. It's, thank God I'm a country boy, sounds bluegrass, and then you have songs like Annie's Song, which sounds very, very, very folk. He was just very difficult to categorize, and I think that part of that sort of gave people at the time a mistaken impression that he was a lightweight, that he really wasn't a serious musician. What would be your reaction to that observation?
Yeah, I would say that not being able to put him in a category, he definitely broke new ground, and he was always searching for that melody and that rhythm and that thing that would touch people. I remember listening to some of his interviews about how he talked about coloring the phrases, and he, when as strong as steel, he would sing it and color the words, and that's something that I learned from him, and that I thought was very, very interesting about him as a singer and an artist.
One of the things that attracted me to his music was that high tenor voice. I mean, that is, that sound is unmistakable. When you hear John Denver's high tenor voice, and it's so lyrical too, I always found that to be perhaps his greatest quality. He had that high tenor voice had a way to touch your emotions that a lot of other singers just don't possess.
Yeah, right. I agree with you on that for sure. Some of those songs, like I said, like Calypso, with the yodeling and it's really very intense, the lyrics about, taking care of the sea and to live on the land, we must learn from the sea. They're great lyrics about, taking care of our beautiful planet and each other.
Yeah. Are there any of his any of his songs that you consider like hidden gems, like a song that very few people really know that John Denver wrote or sang, but that you think are really terrific songs?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I do a song called Love is the Master, and it's kind of an upbeat song. It's got a great guitar riff. And the lyrics are fun, and it's one of my favorites, and it didn't really get a lot of airplay, one of those side B songs that's fabulous. And people love the song, and they say, oh, is that a John Denver song? Like, oh yeah, certainly. It's a great one. So I do some of those songs in my show, and people appreciate those. Of course, the super fans that know every song, they love to hear those.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they do. They do. So what about your band? What kind of instrumentation are you bringing with you?
On this one, I'm playing at Fredonia. In Fredonia, I am being, it's going to be a solo show, just me and my guitar.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it'll be very intimate, very personal. I do a lot of interaction with the crowd, too, so people... I invite people to sing along and the choruses of the songs, and we just have a great time. I really love the solo shows.
Oh, good. Oh, that's good. I don't mind a solo show. I mean, I think that, his material can really carry that. So I'll kind of be looking forward to that, actually. I wasn't aware you were going to do a solo show, but that's nice. That's very nice. Yeah. And the space is really nice for that kind of thing. The Fredonia Opera House is a good place to do a solo show. It's a very intimate space. It seats about, it seats about 400, but still in all, you get a nice feel for that.
Yeah, perfect size.
Yeah, perfect size. Are I take it that things are ticking up for you with bookings after the pandemic restrictions are being lifted?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been crazy. That's a lot of the reason why I've been ping-ponging back and forth across the country. I'll be in Pennsylvania one day and like yesterday, and then I'm in Oregon, you know, all the way across the country, and then back to the East Coast. It's kind of been a catch-up game, you know, with things rebooking. Some of these shows I've had to rebook three or four times,
right?
You know? And but it's been great. It doesn't bother me at all. I don't mind getting on an airplane. It's like getting on a bus for me. It's just part of the job, and I love to meet people. And everywhere I go, you know, airports or what have you, hotel lobbies. I've got my guitar out in the hotel lobby. Did anybody ever tell you look just like John Zimmer? Well, as a matter of fact, that's what I do.
Well,
so
you know,
I have sung to the crew and everything. You know,
that's really funny because I know that. John Denver himself, he did something that a lot of folk musicians did back in the 60s and 70s, was that, you know, he put out his first album, which didn't get a tour, but he went and promoted himself. He just went around the country looking for open spaces to play, cafes, you know, he would take the door or whatever was offered for him, and that's the way he promoted his first album. So I could just imagine you sitting in an airport lounge, just, you know, put your hat down and start playing, and now people will probably... You'll probably get enough to make your airfare there, Ted.
Oh, boy. One time we were in Denver, Colorado, at the airport. I was with a friend of mine who plays mandolin, and he had his mandolin with him, and I had my guitar. We were carrying it on the plane. And somebody said, oh, hey, could you guys do a song? Well, we broke out our instruments. We played a couple songs. The next thing you know, we had about 100 people standing around us. The security guys came up, and I said, you boys have a permit? We're like, no, we didn't know we had to have one. Well, you're going to have to stop. I mean, we had a big crowd, people throwing money. It was hilarious.
That's a good story. That's a wonderful story. It's too bad you have to have a permit these days to entertain people. But, man, that's something.
Well, it wasn't that we couldn't entertain. It was that people were throwing money, and they said to, the guys were like, hey, you know, all that, we could just take all that money right now and we could take your instruments. I said, okay, well, we'll go ahead and stop then. You can have the money. Just don't take my guitar. I'm on my way to a show.
That's great. That's a wonderful story. Listen, Ted, I promised that I wouldn't keep you long, and I'm not going to keep you long. But I can tell you that we'll be looking forward to having you in Fredonia, seeing your concert, your solo show. And I know that the audience is going to be thrilled to see you perform as John Denver, because, you know, he was such a great musician, and you're going to get a crowd that really will remember him very fondly.
Oh, I am so looking forward. It's going to be far out. That's what I'm going to say.
Yeah, really. All right, Ted, listen, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And, you know, get some rest before you get here. So we'll see you when you get here.
Okay, sounds great, Tom. See you soon.
Okay, thanks a lot, Ted. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Remembering John Denver with Ted Vigil will be at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Friday, April 29th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $20 general admission, $18 for members, and $10 for students. See the show notes for this podcast for more ticket information. And finally, don't forget to register for the 5th Annual 1891 Run for the Fredonia Opera House, which will take place on Sunday, April 24th, 2022, beginning at 9 a.m. If you can't make the run, please consider making a donation by following the links to the registration website and making your donation. And that's it for this Pink Moon edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Mr. Rick Davis, Mr. Ben Sheedy, Ms. Ashley Jocho, Mr. Jong Sang Ru, and Mr. Ted Vigil for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our website and spreading the word through your social media websites. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. We'll return in 2 weeks on April 27th, 2022. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another. Rocky Mountain High.